stealing our democracy.
Political assassination of a governor? Well, today we are honored to have on, truth be told, former governor of Alabama, the last Democratic governor to ever be elected to the governor of Alabama. Yes, we have Don Siegelman, who was removed from office on charges of bribery and obstruction of justice. And before the removal, he was the only person to ever have held the state's top four offices: Secretary of State, Attorney General, Lieutenant Governor, and then the governor. Former Governor Siegelman served a total of 5 years in federal prison before being released in February of 2017. Today, we're going to dive into his newly released book, Stealing Our Democracy, How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation. Was Governor Siegelman a political target by the Republican Party? Well, today we're going to find out, and we're excited to have him and bring the latest. I'm Tony Sweet with Captain Ron. You're listening to Truth Be Told right here live. Please welcome to the Truth Be Told studios, former Governor Don Siegelman. There he is.
My family clapping in the background.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, we're excited to have you here because we like to get into those controversial topics and sometimes political movements. And I know we sometimes get in trouble with them, but we don't care because we have a good time. We have a good time. But you have a new book coming out that we want to talk about, and it's called Stealing Our Democracy. And before we get into the book, I want to find out, I mean, leading up to your removal, there was a lot of stuff going on. And I just want to find out, when did the investigation begin on you and how did it start? Because a lot of people, it's been a while since this happened, so they just want, maybe we can get caught up on that.
Yeah, it's almost ancient history, except it's not, because the abuse of power that brought me down is going on today. And, you know, the abuse of power is not limited to Republicans, and I want to make that clear. Anyone who holds power can abuse it. And it so happened that I was a target of Karl Rove's cronies in Alabama. But let me just go back and refresh people's memory, or
yeah, please,
inform your listeners and viewers. I had been elected governor. I was defeated a Republican incumbent to be elected in 1998, took office in 1999 in January. In March, just some 6 weeks after I had taken office, an investigation was started by Karl Rove's client, the state attorney general. It's not just my word that Karl Rove was involved in my prosecution. We have sworn testimony from a Republican lawyer who was hired by my opponent to do negative research on me. She came forward feeling remorse or guilt and went to the House Judiciary Committee and gave them a sworn statement that she was on a telephone conversation with the husband of my prosecutor when he said that he had spoken to Carl and that Carl had gotten the Department of Justice to pursue me. But, you know, we can get into other details later, but the question would be, why would he care?
Right.
Why would
that
Carl
would be
Rove
my
care?
Question.
Well, the Kiplinger letter, the Business Journal, had reported on March of 2001 that I was a likely dark horse candidate for the Democratic nomination in 2004, saying that I was in a position to carry the South and give the Democrats the best chance they had against George W. Bush, the same as Jimmy Carter emerged from the South and Bill Clinton after him. It wasn't just Karl Rove's client who started the investigation. It was Karl Rove's business partner in Alabama's wife, who was appointed U.S. attorney by George W. Bush, who kicked the federal investigation into high gear. It was Karl Rove's bagman, Jack Abramoff, and three of Karl Rove's college Republican buddies, this little tight group that he hung around with during those days and all the way through during the Bush presidency, who became involved in orchestrating my defeat. Jack Abramoff funneled some $20 million of Indian casino money from the Mississippi Choctaw Indians into Alabama to defeat me. He, Jack Abramoff, along with Mike Scanlon, who was later convicted of a crime of bilking these Indians out of this money, and Ralph Reed, who claimed to be the president of something called the Christian Coalition operating out of Georgia, and a guy named Grover Norquist, who operates a nonprofit today called Americans for Tax Reform. But those four people, all friends of Karl Rove, orchestrated the funneling, the laundering of $20 million of Indian casino money into Alabama to defeat, to defeat me and to defeat a proposal that I had on the table called the Alabama Education Lottery, which would have provided free college education and early childhood learning to all of Alabama's children. There were other people, other whistleblowers who came forward later in the course of this, my investigation. And after the trial, a Republican lawyer for the Republican National Committee gave sworn testimony that he had been part of a discussion with the state Democratic Party chairman and that they were going to use the Department of Justice to bring me down to win the election. I'd like to go back at some point to cover in more depth what happened in 2002 and the two trials that I faced. But I want to give you guys a chance to ask a question if you want.
Well, the first thing is, going into politics, you know, it's a dirty game. I mean, most people we hear about, oh, you know, I want to get into politics, I want to change the world, I want to make it a better place. But then you see a lot of these people get into politics and they go into Washington, to state government, whatever, even local. And it somehow seem to be corrupted very quickly, both sides, or at least a change in personality. How soon of you getting into politics that you noticed a lot of corruption and around you? I mean, ultimately you were accused and charged and sent to prison for it. When did you notice that politics was dirty?
Or worse than you thought.
Or worse than you thought.
Like, we all know it is. Right. It just isn't worse than you thought.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you were describing how people feel, or some people feel when they, you know, jump into politics.
Right.
I, too, wanted to, and still do, want to change things and make things better for people. And that's why I chose public service as a avenue to do that.
Right.
And I did that successfully as two terms as Secretary of State, as Alabama's Attorney General, Lieutenant Governor, and Governor. Made changes in voting laws as Secretary of State to make it easier for people to register and vote. And as Attorney General, I cracked down on drug dealers and drunk drivers because my wife and I were nearly killed, or she was nearly killed by a drunk driver. And made changes in Alabama's health care laws as lieutenant governor. And as governor, brought in five automobile plants, Honda, Toyota, Mercedes, Hyundai, and a second Honda plant. We built 600 new bridges and had the largest road and bridge construction project. It started over 1,000 new school construction projects to get kids out of portable classrooms and get them into safe learning environments. But it was those kinds of activities that brought me into the national spotlight as a person who could emerge from the South as a possible challenger to George W. Bush. Hmm. You guys are in California, I believe, and you're familiar with Gray Davis.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And it's interesting that Karl Rove had a conversation with Enron's president before the rolling blackouts became widely known and involved. Two people were recruited to work with him, Ralph Reed and Grover Norquist, and both of them were involved in the demise of Gray Davis. Gray Davis at the time was the lead prospect for the Democratic nomination in 2004. I was hoping that I, by getting into some of the Southern primaries, that I could be on the ticket as his vice presidential running mate. We had Gray Davis and I had a good relationship, so I had these thoughts that if I performed well as a Southerner, there would be a place for me, at least for consideration, on the VP slot.
Right.
And so I think that, talk about that, brought the Republicans into a position where they felt like, now this isn't, I'm not throwing a net around all the Republicans. I'm talking about Karl Rove and a handful of other people.
Right, right.
But there was a Republican state attorney general from Arizona, Grant Woods, who was interviewed by Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes. And Grant Woods was the one of the co-chairmen for Senator John McCain's 2000 presidential race. And he said, Grant Woods, the Republican, said that Don Sigelman was the one Democrat that Republicans couldn't beat fair and square. So they targeted him with this prosecution. Now, there are three people featured on the back cover of my book. One is Donald Trump, one is Jeff Sessions, and the other is Karl Rove. There's a reason for that. And the reason for Donald Trump being there is because the abuse of power that brought me down is also going on today. Now, the reason why Jeff Sessions is on there is because Jeff Sessions was also involved. It was not the FBI that investigated me. It was Jeff Sessions, retired FBI agents. Jeff Sessions had been the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Alabama before he entered state politics as attorney general and U.S. senator. And it was at a time when Jeff Sessions was interested in running against me for governor, that his retired agents were employed to investigate me and build a case against me. Now, backing up to, I mentioned the year of 2001 when the Kiplinger letter said that I was a dark horse candidate for the Democratic nomination. In 2002, I faced re-election. I had a Republican congressman from Alabama running. I wasn't the slightest bit concerned. Political polls were indicating that I was going to win re-election. We went into the election feeling confident. I mentioned that I'd brought in five automobile plants and we'd put a lot of people to work in Alabama. But what happened that night of the election, I actually won. CBS, NBC, ABC, all the national networks called the election for Don Sigelman. The election was closed. It was over. The lights were turned off in the courthouses. Everybody was sent home. And within 4 minutes after the polls closed, in a southern Alabama county, Baldwin County, Republican-controlled county. 6,000 of my votes simply disappeared. They reposted the total, subtracting 6,000 of my votes, which threw the election to my opponent.
It's the closest election ever in Alabama there.
What's that?
That was the closest election ever in Alabama for that.
Yeah, well, the what happened demonstrates my point further, that the election was stolen. I mean, it's easy to say that your election was stolen. But when 6,000 votes are simply subtracted from the total of the top person on the ballot, the governor, you would expect that some votes would be changed in down ballot races for lieutenant governor, state treasurer, auditor, Congress, U.S. Senate. Not one single vote changed in any other race. Only 6,000 of my votes disappeared. Before I could get to Baldwin County the next morning for a hand recount of the place, the one precinct where those votes disappeared, Karl Rove's client, the state attorney general, seized the ballots, took them to Montgomery, illegally certified my opponent as the winner.
Wow.
Which then put us in a catch-22. In Alabama, you can't challenge an election unless you can prove to a judge that there were enough illegal votes cast or legal votes not counted to make a difference in the outcome. Well, because the attorney general, Karl Rove's client, had the ballots and wouldn't let anybody see them or count them, I could not get a recount. So I announced that, okay, guys, you got me on this one, but I'm going to come back and run again in 2006 and win this election and get on with building the state.
And they didn't like that.
It was at that point that Jeff Sessions' retired agents were put into gear. They built the case. They filed the case in federal court in the Northern District of Alabama. The federal judge, the first day of the trial, said that this is the most unfounded criminal case over which I have ever presided in my 29 years and 7 months on the bench. The government dismissed the case with prejudice. Within just days after my formal announcement that I was going to run again in 2006, a second indictment was released that resulted in the trial in 2006. I want to make something clear here too, because about Donald Trump being on the back cover. And I'd like to, and also think about Rod Blagojevich.
Yeah, Illinois.
The governor of Illinois was on tape, recorded, trying to make deals to swap favors, official action, for things that would benefit him personally. In my case, I was not accused of taking a single penny. The contribution, the one contribution that sent me to prison, was a contribution to my Alabama education lottery proposal, the ballot referendum that was being opposed by Jack Abramoff and the Mississippi Choctaw Indians. They funneled $20 million illegally into the state. I raised money legally, $500,000, to promote the passage of the lottery, which would have sent kids to college for free and provided universal early learning for all of Alabama's kids. There was no evidence of any quid pro quo, much less an express one, as in Blagojevich's case. And if you look at the allegations of Donald Trump's impeachment, you know, there are allegations that, and we heard tape recordings of Donald Trump saying to the president of Ukraine, basically, you can get this money, but I want an investigation. You know, there's a big difference between what sent me to prison and the allegations against Donald Trump and what sent Rod Begorovic to prison. So in my case, there was no quid pro quo, no personal benefit. I did appoint, there was official action. I did appoint a Fortune 500 CEO to a back to a board on which he had served for 12 years, appointed by three previous governors, Republicans and Democrats, a non-paying board. Yes, there was official action. I did appoint this guy, the contributor, to the same board on which he had served for 12 years. But the facts and circumstances surrounding my case are far different from others. My point is, I've given you the background of how the Justice Department can be manipulated to prosecute someone if they want to bring them down. The Department of Justice under Karl Rove was weaponized to go after Democrats and to and basically to leave Republicans alone. In fact, he fired seven Republican U.S. attorneys, David Iglesias being one, who wrote a book blurb for my book. He fired seven Republican U.S. attorneys because they wouldn't do Karl Rove's dirty work. And then they promoted people like those who prosecuted me and rewarded them with, you know.
Right.
So anyway, there's a big difference between my case and others. The point is, abuse of power, whether it's by a Democrat or Republican, has got to come to an end. And if you don't believe that Donald Trump can can manipulate the Department of Justice for a political end, look at the facts. He fired Sally Yates. He fired James Comey. He fired Andrew McCabe. He hired Jeff Sessions, fired Jeff Sessions when he wouldn't, you know, do what Trump wanted him to do with the Department of Justice, and hired Bill Barr, who does. So clearly, the Department of Justice can be shaped for a political outcome. That's not to say that Donald Trump has been abusing his power in the sense of using it to prosecute Democrats, but it is to say that it can be manipulated, it can be abused. And in my book, I lay out a plan where we can, you know, curtail the abuse of power, not just for political prosecutions, but for anybody.
Right.
Now think about it. If they can bring a governor down, and I had the resources to fight, I had people who were willing to contribute to my legal defense fund, and I had good lawyers, lots of them, for decades. But if they can do this to a sitting governor, what can they do to an unemployed steelworker or a beautician, a housewife, the mechanic down the street? What can they do to a man or a woman of color if they want to put them in prison for, let's say, a half ounce of marijuana or more?
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, that actually brings your question. You say you've outlined in your book, but if you're saying that they can take down a governor, how in the hell, if just us everyday folk, how are we going to make a difference? We can vote people in that we hope that can make a difference. But as you can see, if they don't like these people, they're going to take them out. I mean, I'm just going to throw out there with Katie Hill, you know, here in California. She had some nude pictures or something like that, and she instantly resigned. Simi Valley. So it's I'm not talking about just Democrats. I'm talking about even Republicans.
Yeah,
it's
it doesn't matter. Any party, right?
Any party. It's how, if they can take down a governor or even a senator, or I mean, we've seen senators resign due to allegations. And look at Nixon. You know, getting, you know, yes, he broke the law, but it's like they got him out too. He resigned. How do we, just everyday people, Americans, stop this corruption? How can we do that?
Let me make it clear. I don't have an answer for everything.
Right.
I served time in prison beginning in 2007. And I met a lot of people and talked to a lot of people, helped a lot of people, wrote a lot of petitions and briefs, and you know, did what I could to help those that I felt had been wrongly accused or convicted. And what I learned was that, and this was a federal prison.
Right.
So what I'm talking about is both, it's federal, but it's also applicable to state prosecutors as well. The federal government gets 99% of all of the indictments they seek. 99% is a pretty good record, almost flawless, which raises the question, how in the world do they do that? 97% of the people who are indicted plead guilty, about 67% of them before they even get an attorney. The government has a phenomenal record of sending people to prison. But the reason that it's happening is because, as one of your judges, the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, Alex Krasinski, said, the withholding of exculpatory evidence by prosecutors is epidemic. The prosecutors, in the secrecy of a grand jury, can present false evidence, false testimony, withhold exculpatory evidence, evidence that would tend to free a target with impunity. They do this because there is no judge present and there is no lawyer for the target of the grand jury present to object to the testimony or to object to the introduction of evidence. Now, if you're in a civil deposition and a lawyer presents a question that shouldn't be asked or tries to introduce evidence that shouldn't be introduced, the lawyer for the defendant has an opportunity to object. And a magistrate, a judge, decides whether or not that evidence or testimony should be let in. What should happen in grand juries is that the target should be able to have a lawyer present to object to false testimony or to object to misleading evidence. And that those objections should be heard and decided by a judge before the grand jury acts on them. It is indisputable that a grand jury is a critical point of a criminal proceeding. It does no good that our laws require a defendant to have an attorney if they've already been indicted and 97% of them have already pled guilty.
Right.
For a lawyer to have any impact on behalf of those who are innocent or who should not be charged, it is in the grand jury setting. And, you know, there are so many people who, well, I'm just talking about myself. I wouldn't have been indicted if I had had a lawyer present in my grand jury. The two lawyers that were presenting evidence, one of them was, his name is Matt Hart. The Department of Justice itself released a report that was published by the Project on Governmental Oversight, December the 14th, 2015. The government itself, the Department of Justice itself, admitted that in my case, they had evidence that the lead prosecutor who was pushing for my investigation and prosecution was in email communication with my Republican opponent's campaign manager. Now, let's back up. Who was managing my Republican opponent's campaign? It was the husband of the U.S. attorney. Karl Rove's best friend, his business partner in Alabama, was a guy named Billy Canary. They both worked in the Bush Quail campaign. Hmm. When that failed in 1992, they both came to Alabama, Carl Rove and Billy Canary, married girls from Alabama. Rove set up shop on Rosemary Beach in on the Gulf Coast, and Billy Canary settled in with his wife in Montgomery. They worked together to take over political campaigns in Alabama. One of the campaigns eventually was the state attorney general, Carl Rove's client. My point is, the U.S. attorney was connected to Rove. The state attorney general was his client. The lead prosecutor who was seeking my investigation was in email communication with my Republican opponent's campaign manager. And, you know, I was brought to trial 1 month before my reelection in the courtroom where the wife of Carl Rove's best friend and the campaign manager, my opponent, was the prosecutor.
I know Ron said he wanted to ask.
I was pointing at it. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, my thing is, when you wrote this book, I mean, you must have had a lot of information that you wanted to put in this book. And was there some things in the book that you didn't put in the book that you wanted to, that maybe could have got feedback or...
Too sensitive.
Yeah, too sensitive that you didn't want to share with the public, or you wanted to share, but you might have got you in trouble in the long run.
No, I did write a longer book. I had plenty of time to write 5 years.
Right.
I wrote a longer book. It was about 640 pages.
Oh, wow.
And, but when I got out, I shopped it around to some literary agents. They all agreed that it was a good story, but needed to be cut. So, after I got out of prison in February of 2017, I started, you know, trying to compress this 640-page mammoth memoir into a what some have described as a John Grisham thriller, because it has as many twists and turns and unbelievable connections in politics as anybody could ever imagine. But yeah, I shortened it. But no, I didn't leave out anything that I you know, would have gotten anybody in trouble. The people I'm talking about are alive and well. Bill Pryor, Carl Rove's client, whom I'm saying illegally seized and illegally certified the vote that cost me my election in 2002, is seated on the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals now.
Aren't you afraid that guy would come after
that's
you?
That's what I was going to say. Yeah,
right.
They can come after me, but they can't. You know, it's hard to. It's hard for somebody to file a civil damages if you're telling the truth. And I'm not afraid of anything that's in this book. It's documented. It's got, I think, about 40 pages of legal notes. And, if they want to file a lawsuit, I'd be happy to face them and put them under oath and ask them questions. And I don't think that's going to happen.
Right. 5 years is a long time to sit and reflect on your life, you know, decisions you make, and even just what other people have, you know, have done towards you. You know, some people can get bitter, some people can, you know, look for revenge, and some people can, you know, find peace in those 5 years. What was your take on your own reflection in those 5 years, besides writing this book? I mean, it sounds like a great book. I haven't had a chance to read it because it's not out yet, but... What was your take on your own life and what you want to do once now that you're out? What's your goal?
No, good question. I'm gonna give you a couple of examples, and I'm gonna answer your question. I hope we don't run out of time.
Oh, we won't. We won't.
If I told you that the president of the United States sent his lawyer into the Supreme Court and argued that U.S. citizens do not have a constitutional right not to be framed, that would probably shock you. Well, yeah. That's exactly what President Obama did. And on January the 4th, 2010, his lawyer went to the Supreme Court and argued that U.S. citizens don't have a right not to be framed. Do not have a constitutional right not to be framed. The second thing that I would mention that a lot of people don't know is, you know, your listeners, they probably don't know that a judge can add years to a person's sentence, prison sentence, for matters that the jury found that person not guilty. A jury finds them not guilty, but the judge can add years to a person's sentence for those matters for which the jury found the defendant not guilty. In my case, the federal judge tripled my guideline range for matters for which I was acquitted. And the final thing is, I mentioned that 97% of the people plead guilty. The 3% that go to trial, if they testify on their own behalf and the jury finds them guilty anyway, the judge figures, well, they must have lied because the jury found them guilty. Therefore, I'm going to add a perjury charge or an obstruction of justice charge to the half ounce of marijuana or whatever it was that they were being convicted of.
Right.
This happens over and over and over again. So when I saw these things recurring, and when I heard stories about false evidence being presented or exculpatory evidence not being allowed, I realized that, you know, if you believe that everything has a purpose, or if you believe that in every situation one should look for a reason or a purpose for one being in that situation, I felt like God was telling me, okay, Don, you've seen what's wrong with it. You've seen what's wrong with the criminal justice system. Now go fix it. So that is my quest now. You know, writing this book is not about me. This is about our democracy. This is about preserving and protecting our freedoms. This is about, you know, protecting those who are more vulnerable in society. They don't have the resources to fight back. So what I want to do is to balance the scales of justice, and to do that, to make the changes in the criminal justice system that will protect the innocent. I've got to have credibility to do that. And that's why I'm asking people to pre-order this book, go to Amazon.
Well, hold on, Don. Isn't that going to be tough for you? I mean, it's got all these different charges that you were charged with. I know you were acquitted on 25 counts and this and that. Isn't that going to be tough for you to come from that position?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're exactly right, Captain Ron. That's why, you know, it's important that that my book be read and be read broadly, so that people will understand that our criminal justice system is out of balance. There was a guy named Juan Garcia, after Obama started giving out pardons for people who had been convicted of marijuana, I went around and I was asking some of these guys, you know, what was your charge? And Juan Garcia had been charged in 1997 with a half ounce of marijuana. He was given a felony but put on probation. 1999, it was the same thing. Actually, it was 1994, 97, and then 99, he was convicted again on a marijuana charge. No amount, but he was careered out. He was given 25 years for those, because of the two prior felonies of 1/2 ounce of marijuana or more. He was able to get out after 19 years, but the fact that somebody would be sent to prison
for that long,
one for marijuana, right, and two for a half ounce of marijuana or more, is insane. But we find it rampant across the country, and right, you know, people deserve a fair trial. And in order to get a fair trial, they've got to have there's got to be a balanced approach to a grand jury. Right now, prosecutors are immune from civil liability no matter what they do in a grand jury. They can present false evidence. They can withhold exculpatory evidence. They cannot be sued civilly because of the Federal Tort Claims Act, which grants them immunity. So we need to repeal that immunity in the Federal Tort Claims Act so that prosecutors can be held civilly, at least, civilly responsible for sending, taking somebody's life away. And then secondly, we need every interview with every witness recorded, and those recordings turned over to the defense before the trial. In my case, the one guy that testified for the government had been interviewed for 4 years. He had been interviewed, according to 60 Minutes, over 70 times. And he had been made to write and rewrite his proposed testimony over and over until he got his answers straight, meaning until he got his answers the way the prosecution wanted them. And so we need to have those interviews recorded and those recordings turned over to the defense so that we can ensure that people have a fair shake, that the scales are balanced, so they have a fair shot.
Well, we only have just a few minutes left. And, I mean, as you know, and everybody sees, there's such a division in America right now. I mean, I think there always has been. It's just there seems to be more visible now. And, you know, in Washington, we see it all the time. In the state houses, we see it all the time. Is it really in politics, is it really the division that bad just for the pursuit of power for the parties itself? Because something just doesn't seem right to me when it comes to, we always say we're Americans first, but yet it seems like we're so divided. I'm forget the religions and forget all this other stuff, but is it just mostly power when it comes to politics itself?
Well, it really makes no sense. Johnny, you're exactly right. There is absolutely no reason for the political parties to be so dug in and so unwilling to work together to compromise in what would be the best interest of the people of the country.
Right.
Maybe we saw a little of that in this relief package that was passed, but there's so many other issues that can be solved if people would only, as you said, become Americans first and put the interest of Americans
right
before whatever else it is. Now, part of it, of course, is driven by campaign contributions and people seeking re-election and worried about where they're going to get the money to run these expensive campaigns on television campaigns. And the amount of money that we spend is obscene, and it forecloses most average people from entering into politics. I'm not one for big government, and I'm not one and I'm not even sure this would work, but having a public funded campaign. But if there was a way to eliminate or restrict the amount of money, we've seen Citizens United and the top's been blown off of that. So I'm not sure where we are or how we can get back to the proposition that you proposed, that members of both political parties ought to consider themselves Americans first and do what's in the best interest of the country.
Amen to that. Well, we are honored to have you on the show. People, please go to stealingourdemocracy.com. You can check out the website. Go to Amazon. Pre-order June 16th. This book is going to be released. And Governor Sigelman is going to be, I'm sure, going to be doing a lot of tours and interviews. And we hope and wish you good luck with everything. And please, your open invitation to come back and visit us. And if you're ever in Los Angeles, please stop into the studio. We'd love it.
will be in Los Angeles for a book signing after June 6th, 8th. So I'll look forward to seeing you.
Please, please stop in. And all right, well, everybody, thank you guys so much for tuning in. We always appreciate you supporting us, subscribing to our channel. Leave a review if it's only if it's bad about Captain Ron. We'd love to hear those. And go visit our website, truthbetoldworldwide.com. Check out all of our upcoming guests. We have amazing guests coming up because we have Contact in the Desert. Fingers crossed they don't cancel that. But, Governor, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you. I hope all of your listeners are taking good care of themselves and their elderly friends, and just be careful. Take care.
Until next time, I'm Tony Sweet with Captain Ron. This is Truth Be Told.